The army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buford. Welcome to War Notes, a conflict podcast in which we will be taking a journey into history, discussing contemporary events, and even doing some conflict futurism. We'll be examining this violent and calamitous clash and collision between complex adaptive systems armed to the teeth to see who will prevail and see what it tells us about the human condition and why we can't stop. This is Bill, and welcome to episode 7 of War Notes, a conflict podcast. The title of this particular podcast is Fixing Fight Club, a continuation of my series, Kill the Core. Now, this will probably be one of my more unpopular episodes in which I am elucidating and articulating a very unpopular notion, which is, in a nutshell, taking the United States Marine Corps and getting rid of it. When one does rather cold-blooded and dispassionate critiques of what needs to be done from a military perspective for America and the West in the 21st century, one has to make hard choices, and this would be one of those hard choices. Originally, I had planned on doing a single episode on land forces in the West and my prognostications and recommendations on how we could quite literally fix them in a way that would make them more appropriate for 21st century warfare instead of fighting the last conflicts of the 20th century. But I decided to, because of its history and the fact that the Marine Corps has such a storied and deserved positive history in what it's done in the past, that I wanted to devote an entire episode to it to give one not only a flavor of past exploits, which are certainly meritorious and worth noting, some of which are not, of course. After all, at the Libertarian Institute, at which I am the Smedley D. Butler Fellow for Military Affairs, General Butler was a general in the Marine Corps who wrote a book called War is a Racket after spending over 3 decades fighting wars for the American government and their corporate customers around the planet, most notably in this case in the Caribbean and Latin America. The U.S. Marine Corps did draft the Small Wars Manual, originally published in 1940 and updated, revised on occasion, and I will include in the show notes FMFRP 12-15, the Small Wars Manual, issued by the U.S. Marine Corps. And apparently, I think this one is dated 22 December 1990. I will see if I can find more recent versions and variants of it. It did have important tactics, techniques, and procedures and ways to train for these particularly small and savage wars that were taking place in developed nations and third world countries around the world at the time. And the USMC found itself not only talented in doing that, but also doing things that one from a current and contemporary perspective would find quite loathsome, like Marine Corps and Army behavior in the Philippines at the end of the 19th century and the turn of the 20th century, conducting the newly minted colonial operations to expand beyond the continental United States, respectively, and find colonial holdings planet-wide. As you know, this War Notes podcast is a companion podcast to my main one, which is Chasing Ghosts in a Regular Warfare podcast, and I have really tried to champion the notion that modern counterinsurgency, insurgency, and most irregular warfare conducted by America in the West is, by its very nature, the neo-colonial warfare of the late 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. So we're seeing that same motif here when it comes to that Small Wars Manual published in 1940. Now, we're going to fast forward to today, and what I want to do is give full faith and credit to the Marine Corps in not only being a martial innovator, a military innovator throughout the august history of its operations to include what was done during World War II with the island hopping campaigns and the Pacific Theater of Operations starting in 1942 and ending in August 1945 during that particular conflict, in which while the Army was a key and more multitudinous player, the Marine Corps, when it came to the tactics, techniques, and procedures, martial imagination, and prior planning, even prior planning to World War II itself, of just how amphibious operations against contested beaches would occur in concert with the Navy, if it weren't for all the hard work done by the Marine Corps in the decades before World War II, that particular island hopping campaign would not have been as successful as it was to take on those contested beaches. And of course, we can fast forward from the end of World War II to the Korean War in 1950, when MacArthur does an end run around the peninsula and makes a lightly contested amphibious landing at Incheon in Korea. And since that time, 75 years ago, three quarters of a century, no amphibious landing against a contested beach has been conducted by the U.S. Marine Corps, and by the way, for the most part, with the exception of the British Falklands campaign in 1982, no such contested beachheads have been bested by any U.S. or Western forces, even in developing countries and third world countries. And let's remember, even back in the ancient days, it seems from this perspective, in 1982, the British lost a considerable number of ships and troops and aircraft as a result of the Missile Age being on the verge of becoming the senior partner in warfighting. And now we fast forward to today, and we find that here we are in 2025, and we are well on our way to having the Missile Age absolutely dominate all aspects of warfare, to include irregular, but in this case, near-peer and peer conflict. Let's run some of the numbers on the Corps. Here's what we have. We have a $53 billion budget that's just been approved of that nearly $1 trillion budget when you shoehorn in the DOE budgetary considerations for aspects of the nuclear arsenal and research and development. And you also have an actual end strength of these forces. The last I saw was 179. But then I updated those figures and I took a look at some of the new considerations in the Congressional Budget Office, and it appears that the United States Marine Corps for the coming year is going to have an end strength of approximately 177,000 active duty members and 32,000 reserve personnel. The Marine Corps has four divisions, three active, one reserve. Fourth Marine Division is the reserve. First and third in the Pacific, or assigned to the Pacific. The second is assigned to the Atlantic, but that in itself is a story that has led me to the conclusions to kill the Corps, as I mentioned earlier. This is against an Army strength of approximately 500,000 versus the 177,000 in the U.S. Marine Corps, and they presently boast 10 active duty divisions, among which is one Air Assault Division, one Airborne Division, the 82nd, and I will cover those in detail in the next episode when we do part two on land forces in this War Notes Fixing Fight Club series. Now, back at the conclusion of World War II, there was a Key West Agreement in 1947 and 1948 in which the Army fought hard to take the Army Air Forces, which it had total possession of until the Air Force was created in 47 and 48 after the conclusion of World War II, in a bureaucratic food fight over fixed-wing assets. The Army lost. They can maintain a very small fleet of general movers, which would be commercial jet and propeller-driven fixed-wing aircraft. But as far as combat aircraft, fixed-wing aircraft would more reliably be given to the U.S. Air Force to conduct support of all the other services, to include the Marine Corps in certain aspects, such as refueling. But when it came to the Marine Corps and the Navy admirals had a very successful routing of this possible carve-out by the U.S. Air Force of their ability to maintain a fixed-wing fleet that would be independent of the U.S. Air Force. And the Marines, being a department of the U.S. Navy, were fortunate enough to have their own fixed-wing assets assigned to them, which led, along with the rotary-wing assets and amphibious craft and ships and support ships and the entire what's referred to as the Gator Navy of amphibious support craft, they were able to carve out this combined arms force in which they were hermetically sealed into the Marine Corps as far as reaching a contested beach. Now, I said hermetically sealed as far as delivery, not as far as support, because they would also, of course, rely on the U.S. Navy not only to provide protection and support to the Gator Navy on its arrival, much like many of those storied legends from World War II, in which aircraft carriers, naval aviation, U.S. battleships, U.S. cruisers, destroyers, and such provided plenty of both gun and aviation support for beach landings during that time in the Pacific Theater of Operations. And you can find plenty of other books and podcasts, discussions, reviews, and folks talking about where they have actually recorded what happened during that war when it came to amphibious landings against contested beaches. All of that is out there, and I'm not going to trouble you with detailed information about that during this particular episode, and as a matter of fact, in this podcast, because that simply isn't within my portfolio of what I'm trying to get at here. Here's what I want you to remember about World War II. Very unique circumstances, very unique time, given the technology, the era, the military leadership, the martial imagination. As I mentioned earlier, hats off to Major Pete Ellis, who divined and made many of the innovative changes in the Marine Corps before 1940 to prepare them for a very successful island-hopping campaign in the Pacific as a result of all the hard work when the Marine Corps put a shoulder to the wheel before the war even started to perfect how that would happen, for instance, with the Higgins boats and the landing craft. How did we come across those? Well, as a matter of fact, there were Marine officers who were stationed with the Japanese Navy in as exchange officers in the 1920s and 30s and watched successful Japanese operations against both contested and uncontested amphibious approaches in the wars that they conducted in the 1930s, took notes and came home with that in the design of the Gator Navy that would prevail by the U.S. over the Japanese in World War II. An interesting counterfactual, all things being equal, if during World War II they had 21st century missile technology, or even the missile technology that really came to the fore in the 1980s and 1990s, amphibious assaults via maritime connectors from ships to the beach on contested beaches with the folks who defended said beaches having missile technology would not have come off as successfully as they did during that time until 1945. The point that I'm making is that all credit has to be given to the Marine Corps for the extraordinary feats of martial success and grit that was seen in the Pacific Theater in World War II, but that time is over and it will never be back. Much like my notions about the aircraft carrier, I consider amphibious operations via maritime connectors, even vertical envelopment via helicopters, to be an anachronism, to be a crossbow and chariot in the 21st century. Hence, once again, we discover that there's not really a purpose for this purpose-built force, the Marine Corps, that was really good in World War II, but not very good in the modern world. One administrative mention here. Remember I said 177,000 Marine personnel. And you've probably heard me say either in this podcast series or in the Chasing Ghosts podcast where I talk about the 1 to 10 tooth-to-tail ratio, which means that for every trigger puller that goes forward, there, just to make the math easy, there are approximately 10 folks behind them who aren't trigger pullers who are there to provide the combat arms support, the combat arms service support, and all the other things that go into making sure that the trigger puller, the infantryman, the rifleman, is actually properly victualed, supplied, fueled, taken care of, medical aid afforded, things like that. A very expensive tail and a very extensive tail. Because when one crunches the numbers, what you discover is that there are approximately 22,000 infantrymen, that would be the 0311 MOS in all of its variants in the Marine Corps, and 7,200 reserve infantrymen. So let's make the math easy here. We're going to call that 30,000. That means it is 30,000 out of 177, which means that if the tooth to tail I just mentioned was 1 in 10, it appears that their tooth to tail may be more like 1 in 6. Somebody else has probably crunched the numbers on that, and I'll give the Marine Corps the benefit of the doubt and say, well, let's stipulate that that's correct. And I'm also going to let you take a look at some of the details for the nuts and bolts of ships, USMC aviation, USMC land fighting capabilities, and things like that. That I'll put some notes in the show notes concerning those. I want to give credit where credit is due. I would probably not be proposing what I am if it weren't for not only what I call this emerging missile age that makes so much of what the U.S. Marine Corps does anachronistic, but the tenure of one Commandant of the Marine Corps, David H. Berger, from 2019 to 2023, who designed what's called Force Design 2030, in which he completely reimagined what the Marine Corps would do, what its purpose was, what its capabilities would be, how those capabilities would be distributed, and in my mind, probably one of the most awful and ill-imagined martial reconstructions of a major military arm in recent history. Just awful. Because his primary focus was upon developing missile units intended to sink Chinese warships from an island-hopping campaign, a littoral campaign, in which isolated, mind you, I'm using the term isolated, Marine Corps units with missile capabilities would shoot and scoot among the islands after acquiring a target, in this case, let's call it a Chinese ship, firing a missile on said Chinese ship, and then maybe repositioning themselves on the island or to another island. So much of what was thought to be a good idea and a good tactics and strategy practicum in this doesn't stand up to the test of inquiry and cross-examination. And this is the same commandant, General Berger, who really put the kibosh on a vital and rather rambunctious discussion about Force Design 2030 so that former and active duty Marines could debate this in a way to say, well, what are the holes? What's some 10th man or contrarian viewpoints on this? Does it stand up to cross-examination? Does it stand up to inquiry? In my mind, after examining a lot of the primary and secondary source documentation for Force Design 2030, not only do I think it is strategically ignorant and just so tactically compromised, but there was a censorious campaign conducted by the USMC to make sure that dissenting voices on this very thing would be crushed or zeroed out in every way possible in official Marine correspondence. Remember what I said, for the first time in Marine Corps history, a commandant came on board who said that I am not going to be a planetary 911 force that would do non-combatant evacuations, come to the rescue of embassies, provide what was often referred to as a 911 force that would conduct all of the operations I just described, but also maybe they would be there just in time with the right stuff as an expeditionary force before the main forces can arrive by either ship or airborne connector to a flashpoint or trouble spot around the planet. This commandant took 200 years plus of goodwill and flushed it down the toilet in pursuit of a regional capacity and a regional response, in this case, China and the second and third island chains and the Western Pacific, and said the Marine Corps would concentrate all of its combat power on protecting or conducting operations there with an operational concept, what I just described, Marines lobbing missiles from islands to take on Chinese shipping, whether that would be combatant or as otherwise instructed, and that they would shoot and scoot and be able to protect themselves, which is highly suspect from all angles when you examine how that happens. As a matter of fact, one of my earliest critiques of this was I asked myself, what faith does the soldier have? Let's suppose you are in one of these littoral combat regiments. You're a small platoon or maybe a company minus. You're on an island. The balloon has gone up. You're at war with China. You send missiles aloft. You don't think the Chinese have sophisticated counter-battery fire. You don't think that their A2AD network, not only in the Chinese mainland, but in the second and third island chains, would have the sophisticated means and the missile depth in their magazines to conduct the counter-battery fire to take it out. And by the way, wartime, peacetime, somebody gets injured. By the way, somebody gets injured in peacetime. How do you evacuate them from that island in a stealthy fashion that doesn't alert, in this case, the Chinese or whoever their co-conspirators happen to be in this campaign? How do you not alert them to the presence of a Marine company minus or platoon on that island? For instance, we don't even have the combat search and rescue stretch in the Pacific region, much like was conducted in World War II with seaplanes and submarines, when those submarine pickets would be there to pick up downed aviators, whether naval or Marine Corps in this case. Now, mind you, that's another bone to pick for me, is that America, especially its Navy, has no mature seaplane capability. The Japanese just so happen to have one of the best seaplanes. It's a gigantic aircraft. I think it's called the US-1. No, it's the US-2. There have been fanciful extrapolations where they said, we'll take the C-130 aircraft, one of the finest aircraft ever produced in the American inventory, and we'll make it capable of seaborne landings. Not probable, not possible. And here we have a perfectly serviceable aircraft that, with minimal investment and revamping and reflagging, could be incorporated into the U.S. Navy inventory in the next year, but that will hasn't happened yet. But getting back to my original point is that if you can't conduct combat search and rescue in peacetime, how are you going to do it in wartime? Because here's what happens. If aid is required for an injured Marine in a platoon, company minus, maybe a battalion minus, that happens to be on the island and has to be evac'd, how do they do it? And when they, since we don't have the capacity in the first place, nor the capability, how do you do that in a stealthy fashion? Well, you can't, because it absolutely violates the TTP for survivability of this entire concept. This entire burger concept of this littoral Marine Regiment TTP in the Western Pacific to fight the Chinese and putting all of the chips in the Marine Corps cupboard on this particular game and saying all is well and good and we can do this, it is intellectually bankrupt from stem to stern. It simply gets worse. Berger did away with 21% of the personnel in infantry battalions, 100% of the tanks, 67% of the cannon artillery batteries, 33% of the assault amphibious companies, nearly 30% of marine aviation, and almost all assault breaching equipment. The desired number of large amphibious ships was reduced from 38 to 31. And due to these cuts, Marines are less capable to fight as a combined arms force, period. The Marine Corps cannot seize a city from an entrenched army, as it did in Fallujah in 2004. It cannot fight on a battlefield such as Ukraine. One side note, as you know, I think the revolution in military affairs in the 21st century is a combination of hypervelocity munitions, robotics, and autonomous targeting, which means that devolution and elimination of tanks, I'm okay with that. I think that was a smart move. The elimination of tubed artillery, I think that Russia has proven in the Ukraine that artillery in all of its permutations, because I do consider in a 21st century variant that UAVs, UASs, and all airborne FPVs and munitions-carrying objects that are airborne are part of artillery, and that's the way the planning takes place in the Russian military when it comes to fighting with artillery, which makes them an artillery-centric organization instead of an aviation-centric organization, as is the U.S. military, and in particular, the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps in two aspects. Number one, because of the concept of vertical envelopment, which for the longest time would be the replacement for the lack of maritime connectors. A maritime connector would be an amphibious craft that comes from its mothership and lands on a contested beach under the protective fires of a naval armada, maybe even helicopter gunships and aircraft and such, because that capability is simply impossible in the 21st century for a variety of reasons. All in all, I think Berger's Force Design 2030 is a non-starter. It simply doesn't work. It doesn't stand up to the sobriety test of warfare, and it doesn't meet the math when it comes to the grunt math of discovery as a result of surprise first launches from these littoral combat regiments and their distributed parts and pieces all across these island chains with these heretofore unknown missile batteries and complexes by these trained Marines to take out Chinese shipping. It simply doesn't meet the mail in military sobriety and thought. I'm going to riff off of one of my favorite contemporary authors, who is Bing West. I urge you to read his books if you get the opportunity. I have talked about Bing West because he took on the counterinsurgency nonsense in an earlier book, and I will put some of his books in the show notes. Bing is still alive today. He was born in 1940. He served in Vietnam. He's written a dozen books, among which The Last Platoon, a novel of the Afghanistan War. I highly recommend it. Like my other favorite one, Tattoo Zoo. It's one of those seminal novels that sort of defines a war, especially for those who happen to have served in Afghanistan or Iraq. So what's been gained by shredding the Marine Corps' historic image and reducing its capability to fight in any place or climb? In theory, China is further deterred. This was the claim by Berger. On paper, the Marines will be prepared by 2030 to land small units on a dozen islands or atolls in the South China Sea. Each unit will include 8 or 10 anti-ship missiles mounted on heavy trucks, plus sophisticated naval intelligence devices to detect ship movements. When and if Chinese warships try to exit the South China Sea to attack Guam or wherever, the Marines will track and sink them. This is simply drunken frivolity when it comes to military thinking, because the moment they fire against a peer competitor, and China is not a near peer competitor or a third world or developing nation, they are a very sophisticated nation that not only has very deep larders and magazines of missiles, because the 21st century is the age of missiles. And remember what I've discussed before. If you've listened to my other episodes in this particular series, this will be a war of leakers. And in this case, once those missiles are lobbed, and by the way, when they describe 6 to 8 missiles and such, and if these Marines are hiding out on these islands in the island chain, they will have nothing to defend themselves with, even if they disperse. And what you find is that there's so much bad thinking, as I mentioned, from stem to stern in this, that it defies explanation. What you would actually be doing is taking these Marine Corps platoons, companies, battalion minuses, and issuing them a death warrant, because on every one of these islands, whether they are savaged by Chinese missions or they are savaged by Chinese landing teams that go there on search and destroy missions to injure, maim, and kill every one of these Marines who happens to be on these islands so proximate to the Chinese mainland, it's so ill thought out, it defies imagination in my mind. By the way, the Philippines has refused to permit U.S. forces to use its bases as a staging area, let alone land on its islands in the South China Sea. Plus, the Marines don't have the shallow draft ships to get to these islands, as I mentioned earlier, concerning maritime connectors and how poorly maintained and designed that force has been, not only after World War II and especially after 1980, but even now in the 21st century, they're all museum pieces. When I employ the Argo of maritime connector, what I'm talking about is surface craft that go from the Gator Navy ships, those 31 that I mentioned, to the shoreline, whether that shoreline is contested or uncontested. Again, in this missile age, we have to assume that that shoreline will be contested, even if there's not a single peer or near peer soldier or marine on that island at the time, because missiles are pretty agnostic about their location as long as they can reach their intended target. The Navy, of course, with its shipbuilding woes, is reluctant to build these, and they simply haven't secured the Marines' pledge that such ships would pull out before shooting war began. This means the Marines may never get to the islands. Mind you, they have to get to the islands in a stealth fashion because the persistent surveillance by the Chinese and their allies in the Western Pacific of what goes to and from these islands is pretty manifest in and of itself. In addition, these islands are 1,000 miles south of Taiwan. If Taiwan is the focus of Beijing's future aggression, the Marines have placed themselves out of position. In short, the anti-ship mission lacks strategic coherence as well as resources. This is Bing West speaking, and I agree completely. General Berger concocted this concept in secret, by the way, as I mentioned earlier, not consulting the retired four-star community that, appalled by his extensive cuts, the ones I had mentioned earlier, they've united in opposition. Multiple articles have been written laying out the irredeemable defects in the anti-ship strategy. To sink some Chinese warships in a dubious war scenario, marine resources and organizational cohesion have been severely damaged. Berger's injudicious change of direction will adversely affect marine warfighting capabilities, internal morale, and recruiting for years to come. You know, and when you think about it, it sounds like a modern Maginot line. That was that French fortress that took decades to build on the eastern frontiers between Germany and France. And in this case, it is a Maginot line, much like the one in 1940, which they simply went around. Just sail your Navy attack group somewhere else and bypass those Marines on an island staring at their radar screens. By the way, isn't it ironic that all of a sudden in the island campaigns in the Pacific, in which all of those Japanese troops were doomed by U.S. Naval, U.S. Army, and U.S. Marine Corps superiority in men, arms, and equipment, that we're sort of taking a page out of the Japanese handbook itself by saying, yep, we're here in the 21st century, marching on to 2050, and we're going to take the Japanese playbook, and we're going to put Marines in those doomed positions. It makes no sense whatsoever. Bing goes on to say, quote, "Damn shame of what Berger has done to the Corps. We already had our mission of first to fight handed off to SOCOM, but we still had the flexibility and depth to handle and win in remote and diverse battlefields around the world. What Berger and his cabal of thinkers," and he puts that in quotes as he should, "did was strip the Corps of its flexibility and narrowly aim it at a sort of wake island future where Marine units and their very expensive missiles are abandoned to either languish or to be consumed piecemeal by the very capable and modernized Chinese People's Army. They read our publications, you know. Anyone remember what happened to the Marines at Wake Island? I urge all of you to take a look at that. What happened was they were taken prisoner. Many of the civilian contractors were literally worked to death. And Wake Island was abandoned by the U.S. Navy and the U.S. after the Pearl Harbor fights. Those who were not immediately killed spent 3 long years as POWs of the Japanese." And just to enter a note of realism, if the Navy can get us to those islands in time before war breaks out, remember what I've said about stealth and about wanting to be there so that the Chinese have no clue whatsoever that they could be within the radii of anti-ship missiles employed by Marines on these tiny island chains. Who will be available to medically respond to major casualties, as I mentioned earlier? Who will conduct the combat search and rescue? How do you conduct combat search and rescue to get a Marine out in peacetime who has stubbed his toe, or a Marine out who is in danger of losing his life in wartime? How do you do that stealthily? Well, you don't. And if you don't evacuate him, he dies. If you do evacuate him, you condemn all of his brothers in that particular Marine Corps unit to a rather savage and fiery death as a result of that CASAVAC taking place and alerting the Chinese to what military units just so happen to be on that island that they're surveilling. You know, what plans are there for evacuating those casualties, rescuing, reinforcing, extracting our Marines from these widely separated islands, much less the logistical needs of a persistent presence there by military personnel? They can't just forage from the land or go fishing to find what they need. They need to have the petroleum, oil, and lubricants and maintenance modalities for their missile systems, their small arm systems, being able to defend themselves, all of these things. But it seems as if all of this was created in a vacuum in which they didn't take the literally thousands of years of hard-won military wisdom and applied it to this very ill-thought-out and, in my mind, ill-fated mission set for the Marine Corps by Berger. Berger has conducted a military-style institutional seppuku that should be studied and will resonate for decades in how not to lead a major military arm. And in this case, my suspicion is he has led the Marine Corps into oblivion if Force Design 2030 ever comes to life. And as a person, one of the rare people in America who has actually read field manuals, and I've helped to draft two of them, when I looked at some of the stuff, and William Lind had a hand in this, when you look at FM-FM1, Marine Corps Doctrinal Pamphlet 1, and Maneuver Warfare, these were clear, concise, easy to understand, and supportable. I wouldn't say they read like novels, but they had such a great flow to them. They made sense. They were concise. They were very clear in what they were trying to get across, and they provided a doctrinal framework under which combat capabilities could be maximized and optimized. And then you compare that to the tentative manual for Force Design 2030 and the EABO, and it's awful stuff. It's turgid. It almost smacks of just military madness and how it ignores literally thousands of years of TTP and tradecraft that have informed the proper doctrinal framework for how to win wars. Look, here's what Berger has done, and here's what all of his co-conspirators in the Flag Officer Corps of the Marine Corps have done. They've dismantled the Marine Expeditionary Forces, and they've greatly reduced the capability of the entire Corps to perform the mission of a tasked, organized Force Recon Anglico Company. Anglico would be the air, naval, gun liaison companies that direct naval and aviation fire, much like the CTTs of the Air Force, onto targets to support the combatant that they're supporting. So the Marine Corps today is not conducting non-combatant evacuation operations, NEOs. It's not in Europe training Ukrainians or whoever. It's any climb or place. That motto has been replaced with maybe one climb, possibly one place. You know, I mentioned Pete Ellis earlier, who in the decades prior to World War II put his shoulder to the wheel to really put the Marine Corps in a good place before that to conduct optimized and lethal amphibious operations against contested beaches. He wrote Operations Plan 712 Hotel, Advanced Base Operations in Micronesia, an island group in the North Pacific Ocean in 1921. At the time, the former farm boy accurately predicted a coming war with the Japanese Empire and set in motion a radical transformation in doctrine that led to the successful amphibious island-hopping campaign of the Pacific. It was a bold and ambitious transformation that saw the Marines go from fighting in the trenches alongside the Army in the battlefields of Europe in 1917 and 1918 to waging amphibious operations across the span of the entire Pacific against contested beaches. I say again, against contested beaches, which is one of the most hazardous and error-fraught entry operations in combat conducted by mankind. And at the time, Ellis had his fair share of detractors, many of whom saw him as a depressed alcoholic, whatever that means. But Ellis was right. Thankfully, he and other leaders of vision dramatically transformed the Corps at the critical time. Remember, he wrote that in 1921. Of all the services, it's safe to say no other study military history like the Marines. This is Bing West speaking. The Marines know that they are at another key moment in history and are again transforming the Corps to meet a rising threat. Actually, it's likely that I do have a greater insight than the CMC and the entire National Security Committee. The CMC, the Commandant Marine Corps, is cutting vital combat power, infantry battalions and cannon battalions, in part to fund extremely expensive missile systems. Those decreased infantry and artillery Marines cannot be reconstituted in a hurry when they will almost certainly be needed. That's Bing West, and I agree completely. By the way, I again neglected to tease out an acronym. EABO is Expeditionary Advanced Base Operations. So Ronald O'Rourke, he's a Congressional Research Service specialist in naval affairs. This guy's produced many quality reports, and I'm your friendly correspondent who takes the time to read the Congressional Research Service papers so that you don't have to. In his latest one, he covers the medium landing ship. Now, I mentioned to you that maritime connectors, those surface ships that go from the motherships to a contested or uncontested beach to deliver Marines and their combat power, it's in a very bad way. And now they're designing, wait for it, a new ship. It's called the medium landing ship. And he says something here that I think should resonate and happen in the undertaking of every major new combat vehicle or modality. Quote, before getting to the latest LSM funding development, medium landing ship, it is worth looking at the inception of the LSM. No one should be allowed to pick up a wrench to start building the LSM without first examining more fundamental questions. The first question is why? Is there any good reason to build any LSMs? The LSMs have been proposed as a crucial part of the Marine Corps' controversial plan to place Marine missile units on islands in the Pacific. Before any answer can be given about constructing the LSM, questions need to be asked about force design itself, that would be force design 2030, and about its related operational concept, EABO. In his LSM report, Ronald O'Rourke lists 9 issues for Congress, I'll put this in the show notes, related to the LSM, force design, and EABO. In addition, O'Rourke provides a substantial index of published articles that explore the LSM, force design, and EABO. Now, mind you, what I think is happening here is that this is the missile age. As Jeff Vandenagel, who wrote Questioning the Carrier, Opportunities in Fleet Design for the United States Navy, has told us in excruciating detail in that book, and I highly recommend it to you, is that missiles in this age do a number of things, among which is, as I mentioned earlier in prior episodes, the coming near-peer and peer conflicts, as we're seeing in the Ukraine and witnessing before our very eyes, is a war of leakers. You can have the most sophisticated integrated air and missile defense array that you wish, but if something gets through, it's going to land in your lap, on your machinery, on your weapon systems, or in your command tent. Whatever the case may be, things will get through. The same applies to modern surface navies. Now, in this case, in the next episode, I will be talking about my recommendations for fixing Fight Club when it comes to the U.S. Navy. But in this case, that Gator Navy that I talked to you about, which is comprised of probably 31 ships instead of 38, which is approximately 10% plus of the entire naval force in the U.S. Navy, really comes into question as far as its viability in a near-peer and peer conflict in the future. Now, when it comes to third world and developing countries and the need for these ships, even that is being called into question. You will note that carrier armada after carrier armada in the last 18 months in the Red Sea off of Yemen, which doesn't possess a navy of any count whatsoever, has fled because the carriers and their protective ships and their pickets and all the rest of it have been subjected to fusillades of missiles that are incoming, and to me, in my mind, it is only a matter of time before one of those missiles impacts a carrier. And as I mentioned before, you don't have to sink a carrier. All you have to do is put a 5-degree list on it or take out a shaft to decrease forward speed so that it can't launch and reliably retrieve aircraft. But then again, the USS Ford, even if it isn't hit by a missile, cannot reliably launch and retrieve aircraft, especially when that aircraft happens to be the execrable and loathsome F-35, which coming into operational status is already an anachronism. So while we're concentrating here on a Jeremiad against the Gator Navy and the very utility of the U.S. Marine Corps in the 21st century, that entire question expands irrevocably and existentially into the entire U.S. Navy and Western Navy's blue water surface fleets. The big question is, and somebody needs to take the time to investigate this and chase the data, chase the numbers, chase the qualitative analysis, and chase the historical outliers that may be there that will help us better define the efficacy and use of these ships. Because I have a very dim feeling that with America's provocations around the world, and if it insists on saber-rattling at near-peer and peer military forces like China and Russia and others that are emerging, for whom the missile is yet another arrow in their artillery quiver, that we will quickly discover that these exquisite platforms, whether they're Gator Navy boats, ships, or they happen to be carriers or cruisers or frigates or destroyers or whatever new name permutation the Navy has twisted to name its latest catastrophe that comes out of shipbuilding. Whatever that may be, one has to measure appropriately if it's worth building them. So let's tie a bow on this analysis. What I have, the case that I've made here is that between 2019 and 2023, Berger, the commandant of the Marine Corps, has done existential damage to the U.S. Marine Corps in 21st century warfare, to such an extent that I'm not even certain if it's salvageable. Now, let's suppose, in a counterfactual, Berger never emerged, he never came up with Force Design 2030, and that the Marines were merrily marching into the future with the same force structure they had before. Again, missiles. Again, what purpose do they serve? Now, mind you, I know that when it comes to, for instance, embassy protection, and in the past, when it comes to NEO operations, non-combatant evacuation operations, they have always done a superb job of doing that kind of thing. When it comes to the very aggressive martial culture of the Marines compared to most Army line infantry units, excepting maybe Ranger Regiment and the 82nd Airborne Division and the 101st, what you discover is that is a force much like the Légion Étrangère, the French Foreign Legion, whose reputation alone could really put the fright and flight into a foe. There's a lot to be gained from that, but nonetheless, that would be rather expensive if that were the only thing one were using the Marine Corps for in this case. So the bottom line for me is this. When it comes to the conduct of amphibious operations to take on contested beaches and beachheads and seize those lodgements, expand from the lodgements, and use that as a means to secure an air landing modality or whatever the case may be to bring in more troops and such, the age of the missile has zeroed out the chances of any of that kind of thing being successful in near-peer and peer operations. So we've got these, as I elucidated earlier, these 30,000 trigger puller actuals in the Marine Corps, for which we have 177,000 in the force total, for which we pay $50 billion a year. And when you look at the tooth-to-tail ratio in the U.S. Army, which has a broader portfolio, which is probably closer to 1 to 10 instead of 1 to 5 and 6, as it appears to be in the Marine Corps. What does one do with the Marine Corps when its entire job appears to be not only in the hazard as a result of its own command structure and what they design as what they're going to be in the future, but of course, in this age of missiles, in this age of autonomous targeting, in this age of robotics from mud to space, in this age where we see this absolute ubiquity and usage of unmanned aerial vehicles, FPVs, munition-laden, remotely piloted aircraft that are unmanned, and all of these things, it has changed the very calculus of warfare. It has made it, as a matter of fact, so that the infantrymen, the 0311 in the Marine Corps, the 11 Bravo, and the 11X, and maybe even by extension, the very small density 18X Special Forces infantrymen analogs and such, they may be entering a phase now in the 21st century in which it has become rather inexpensive in the salvo competition calculus to take them out on the battlefield with a robot vehicle. This is flying in the face of thousands of years of infantry combat in changing the very fabric of how that kind of infantry combat takes place. So this is where listeners are going to bring the hate. And here's my recommendation. It's time to kill the Corps. It's time to get rid of it. And this is going to be an uphill battle, quite literally, because the Corps is a cult. I know it's a cult. I didn't serve in the Corps. I've served with great Marines. I was not in the Corps. Youngest son spent 4 years in the Corps. He had great things to say and not so great things to say about being affiliated and serving with Uncle Sam's misguided children. Nonetheless, he's a member of a cult now, and he finds, for instance, that because he was a Marine, whether he wears that emblem on his truck or he happens to mention it, there's a club out there that takes care of each other. Well, you know what? The same thing happens with the Navy. Same thing happens with the Army. Same thing happens in the Special Operations Forces and Special Forces community. We all tribe up, and we all tend to do that kind of thing. But we really need to take a look in the martial mirror here in the United States and by extension the West and ask ourselves, are the Marines a value added at the margin in a combat context in the 21st century? My answer is they are not. I don't have all the answers on what to do. Should one stand down the entire 177,000 man force? It's also WOMAND. Should that be stood down and all that equipment given and distributed to the Navy, in the Army, and in a smaller fashion to the Air Force? And then what's to be done with those personnel? Well, maybe one can offer a way to meld those into new divisions in the Army. Maybe instead of the 3 active divisions and 1 reserve division, the Army can expand itself by 2 divisions, whether light infantry, mechanized infantry, helicopter infantry like the 101st, 82nd. There's not a lot of analogs for parachute troops when it comes to the Marine Corps. Anglico, Force Recon, and MARSOC tend to be parachute-qualified troops, but not at the levels of echelonment where you have companies, battalions, and by extension, a division in the 82nd that is airborne qualified. But when it comes to vertical envelopment, I think that the 101st Airborne Division learned a great deal by Marine helicopter operations. When it comes to our really elite forces, as I mentioned, the 82nd, the 101st, and even more elite would be Ranger Regiment, there's a lot of commonality in culture between Ranger Regiment and the Marine Corps 0311. Could you expand the regiment by 1 or 2 battalions to take in these orphaned Marine Corps 0311s? Could you create a new division or two in the U.S. Army to take these in? Or, like all things, could you simply say, thanks for serving, here's your paperwork, and you need to go find something else to do? I don't have all the answers, and I'm simply contemplating here. And if somebody comes up with superior evidence that shows that all of the positions and prognostications that I've come up with in the last 54 minutes of this podcast is irrelevant and that the Marine Corps is relevant to the 21st century, let your superior evidence win over mine, and then we will march happily into the sunset together. So what are your ideas? What are your comments? What are your questions? Is there anybody out there who is asking these hard questions? I do know that on the internet, there are various groups out there to include Compass Points on Substack that have been really examining these questions to a depth and breadth that those who are interested in this would really appreciate. So I appreciate you listening, and please note that while Fixing Fight Club has concentrated on defense as the first notion of what America's military should try to achieve, I found that by exception, the Marine Corps doesn't do a lot to defend America proper. So again, that works into my calculus of why I think considering the elimination or folding of smaller parts of this into the U.S. Army may be the optimal solution of making things better when it comes to fixing Fight Club. So if you wish to get in touch with me, please visit my Substack, or you can write me directly at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. I would appreciate sophisticated arguments and discussions that do not find themselves concentrating on ad hominem arguments, but more so addressing the merits or evidentiary basis of the propositions that I've made in this podcast, because I know that this is probably a very not only isolating but contentious podcast topic when I'm talking about taking the United States Marine Corps and telling them simply to go away. So this is Bill. Welcome to the new year in 2025. And as I had mentioned earlier, I did skip a week to spend the holidays with my children. Had a great time with senior son in Salt Lake City, Utah, and all of my children, all of my grandchildren gathered there. We had a lot of great times together. I'm a cruiser head, so I got to spend time at the Land Cruiser Heritage Museum in Salt Lake City, Utah. I recommend any cruiser heads out there, take a gander at that. It was just an amazingly thorough museum. It's also where Toyota, with all of their new Land Cruiser debuts since, well, I would say since the 1990s, that's where it debuts in America, is at the Land Cruiser Heritage Museum in Salt Lake City. So this is Bill wishing you a happy new year. Hope your resolutions will come to fruition, and buckle up, because this is going to be quite the roller coaster ride. This is Bill out.